Committee on Energy and the Environment, Wednesday, March 7, 2007, 1 p.m. in Hearing Room C. Chair, Representative Jackie Kingfelder.
We're going to start off with Senate Bill 89, and I'm going to ask, where's the Water Resources Department?
Right there.
Hey, Devin, I couldn't see you back there. Can you come up, please?
Okay.
So, colleagues, we heard testimony on Senate Bill 89 on Monday. First Monday, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are no amendments to this bill. I wanted to bring Debbie up in case there were any questions for the department. This is, and do you want to just do a brief overview just to remind the committee?
Briefly. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 89 extends to June 30th, 2010, the sunset on a Water Resources Department pilot project allowing temporary transfer of water rights in certain irrigation districts.
Did you want to add anything about the bill?
Madam Chair, I don't have anything to add unless you have any questions for me.
Were there any questions for the department about this? And there are no amendments. Okay. We just lost one of our... Can you maybe see it?
One, two, three.
If Representative Burley wants to come in and vote on this bill. I don't know, Anita, did you want to come up and say anything? Okay. Okay. So I'll take a motion.
Madam Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I move Senate Bill 89 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative McPherson moves Senate Bill 89 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, those of the opinion that Senate Bill 89 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith.
Excused.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Excused.
Representative Burley.
Yes.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Chair Nathan.
Aye. The motion, having received the required majority, is declared passed, and I will entertain a motion for consent calendar.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate Bill 89 be placed on the consent calendar.
Okay, Representative McPherson moves Senate Bill 89 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Okay, is there any objection? All right, so moved. The Senate Bill 89 will be placed on the consent calendar. And with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 89. Thank you. And we will move on to open up a work session on SJM-1 relating to the Hanford Nuclear Reservation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Joint Memorial 1 urges Congress to fund cleanup efforts at Hanford Nuclear Reservation and to expedite cleanup actions in order to safeguard public health and welfare and protect the Columbia River.
Okay. I'll entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move SJM-1 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves SJM-1 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion or any questions? Okay. Seeing none, those of the opinion that SJM-1 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith, excuse. Representative Byers.
Aye.
Representative Vinson, excuse. Representative Burley.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Chair Dinkel.
Aye. Motion having received the required majority is declared passed. And would anybody like to carry this to the floor? No? Yeah. Do you want to see if... he may want to carry it because it's... Would you like to carry the bill for the Hanford? Actually, SJM-1, if you would like. Or we can put it on the consent calendar. Unless you brought it dessert for everybody.
I've carried it now for the last four or five sessions. We might as well try that again.
Okay. Maybe fifth time's the charm.
That way I get a bill that I can probably get passed.
Okay, so we will designate Representative Jensen as the carrier for SJM-1. Would you like to vote on it?
I would. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so I will make a motion to suspend. You have to make a motion to suspend the rules so
Madam
we can
Chair,
have both of you vote on it.
Is there a language you want me to use?
Working for your secretary. You can motion to suspend the rules so you can vote on the bill.
Because we never know what we're going to do.
Okay, we have to do it right, so in case Ramona comes in.
Madam Chair, I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow me to be recorded as voting aye on the motion to move
SJM-1.
SJM-1.
Can you modify your motion? Oh, do I need to read this as well?
Just good practice.
Madam Chair.
Make sure that you're not late again.
I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow me to be recorded as voting aye on SJM-1.
Okay, so there's a motion to suspend the rules. Is there any objection to allow Representative Jensen and Representative Smith to vote aye on SJM-1? No objections. Motion carries. Your votes are recorded.
Senate Bill 89.
It's up to you. This is the pilot project for temporary transfer of water rights.
Madam Chair, I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow me to be recorded as voting aye on Senate Bill 89.
Representative Smith?
Please. And Madam Chair, you are going far beyond the call of duty on this, and I appreciate that. Madam Chair, I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow me to be recorded as voting aye on the motion to approve Senate Bill 89.
Okay, motion has been made to allow Representative Jensen and Smith to vote aye on Senate Bill 89. Is there any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries, and that bill is being placed on the consent calendar. Okay. Now, back to work session on House Bill 2187. Open up this work session, and this is a bill relating to fees for the Department of Human Services sanitary surveys. Can I have Neil Shibley come up? Do you want to just provide a reminder for the committee and an overview of the bill?
It ends looking pretty good.
Okay. Welcome, Gail, back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gail Shibley. I, first of all, want to say thank you for bringing this bill back with a full panel here today. I appreciate the opportunity to make sure that you have the information you need to make the right decision. And I also want to say how much I regret that I did not have the information in anticipation for the last meeting for you, and that I had not done and my office had not done the work that we needed to do within our department to make sure that LFO had the right information. I happen to know, as a former member of Ways and Means and Revenue and other legislative committees, just how critical LFO is to ensuring that you have the right information. And we fell down on that job, and I apologize for that. And I can think of no more important resource than LFO. So I appreciate the opportunity that we've had now to work together. So I think we've got the information that you had requested before, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Dale? Representative Jensen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of committee, refresh a little bit of the history of this bill. A bill appeared before us for the first time two sessions ago, and we had considerable differences of opinion in the users or the people who were going to be affected by the bill. And specifically between municipalities and the department. And we sent them out to do a work group or to iron out their problems out of committee. They were unable to do that, and as a consequence, we gave them all directions to work the problems out so that they were in agreement, that everybody felt good about it. They held I don't know how many meetings. They came out of there with a consensus plan, which is basically what has been presented before you. They brought that plan to us in the last session. Unfortunately, it didn't move forward in part because it got caught up in the end game at the end of the session and was in Ways and Means, and at the end of the session it moved out of committee, but
language than in Ways and Means. I'm happy to say they brought back the, in essence, the same bill now that we were looking at last session that passed out of what was in the Water Committee. The committee that we are now serving on is assuming those issues, and it is very pleasing to me that they have persisted and carried this through. They've done everything fundamentally that the legislature has asked them to do, and Madam Chair, in my humble opinion, they deserve bill deserves to move forward.
Great. Thank you for your comments, Representative Jensen. Are there any other questions or comments?
Madam Chair, I did have a question or comment, but I see that I had just overlooked the revised fiscal analysis that is in front of us today. And since I'm looking at it for the first time, perhaps the director would be willing to explain how it is different from the inaccurate LFO analysis we received at the last hearing.
Sure. Madam Chair, Vice Chair Cannon, without going through each and every difference, I will tell you that the chart that you have on page 2 of 3, I believe, of your fiscal impact statement shows the full accounting, if you will, of all the different types of systems. If you look on, I believe it's the third column all the way down to the bottom where it says total system count, that number 2,648, that is the number of EPA systems that we have in this state. And I believe that, although I don't have it in front of me now, but the earlier chart that was accurate perhaps as far as it went, looked at only some of those systems. And so I just want to make sure that you and all the members of the committee understand that this new fee will be charged to every system. You'll note that the estimated cost and the proposed fee, those are not different from what you had seen before, except that it is complete for all the different types of systems. As a consequence, as you can imagine, the revenue numbers change, and both on an annual and a biennial basis.
Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, thank you. Appreciate it. Oh,
motion. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2187 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative McPherson moves House Bill 2187 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, those in the opinion of House Bill 2187 should be reported to the floor with due pass recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Fire?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative
McPherson?
Aye.
Motion having received required majority is declared passed. And would you like to carry it, Representative Jensen?
I'll be happy to carry it, ma'am.
Okay. So Representative Jensen has volunteered to carry House Bill 2187 since he's worked on this for many sessions. And really appreciate that. Okay, so with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2187. And we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2294. It's related to fish screening. Give us a little overview.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's been several weeks since we've heard these, so we have to remind folks.
House Bill 2294 modifies the current Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife fish screening goal and expands the fish screening cost share program to include cost sharing for water diversions of any size. It retains the current cost share formula under the program but eliminates current expenditure limits and authorizes ODFW to charge actual costs for inspection and maintenance if a person responsible for a screen diversion fails to maintain it. There's an amendment in front of you, HB 2294-1, and I'll defer to Roy Elliker to go through the amendments.
Thank you, Kat. And Roy, if you can come up, throw you back there. I'm short, so I have a hard time seeing all of you who hide in the back. Come up and walk us through this amendment.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Roy Elker, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Again, Ray Harder Road on my right, the program manager for the Fish Breeding and Passage Program. Passing out, hopefully you've all had a chance to take a look. In the last couple of days, I used a handout and got at least to people's offices with a handout that laid out where we had ended up with the amendments discussion, particularly with Water for Life, and I know they're here today, and we'll talk from their perspective. But we did get the amendment just this morning, the actual proposed Dash 1 amendment, but rather than go through that line by line, I figured going through the one pager we prepared, which some of you had a chance to look at prior to this in the handout we gave you, there's four issues on the table that we worked on with Water for Life, and I think we ended up good on most of them, but not all of them. But if it's helpful, Madam Chair, I can walk us through that.
Please.
Okay, so the first issue was the issue of, in particular, the agency wanted a date by which there would be some certainty by which, unless there's some exception, which the Fish Green Task Force can grant, that there'd be a date set that screen for water rights given and screening condition of that the person would be responsible for that at their cost, as a cost of their doing business of a new water right. And that's what number one does. Establishes the date of January 1st, 1996 as the date by which the folks would not be eligible for the cost share program unless there's an exception granted by the Fish Screening Task Force. On the second issue, and there was a lot of discussion about this, and I'm not sure, Water for Life and ourselves in the end did not agree on this, but we felt that with the various forms of funding and issues with that, we thought that by having some preference language, it would make clear in the statute that the department is to give preference to diversions under 30 cubic feet per second when making state cost share funds available. This is the current practice already in the program and reflects that the vast majority of surface water diversions in Oregon are less than 30 CFS. In this, from the agency's perspective, in this discussion of preference for under 30s versus over 30s, which can take a lot more money and be a lot larger, again, one of the issues we have is that the Fish Green program is one of the few programs in the state that has a legally established task force that meets quarterly to advise the department on how to proceed ahead on responsibility, projects, and the like, and policy on fish screening. We have a similar task force set up, and frankly, it's set up because of the success of the Fish Screening Task Force. We also now have a Fish Passage Task Force that does exactly the same thing. And just for the record, the Fish Screening Task Force, the qualifications and its duties are found at ORS 496. 0.085, and I did want to just put into the record, notice here's the comprehensiveness of what the screening task force by law does. First of all, in the duty section, part three, it advises the department in development of a comprehensive cost-sharing program. It advises the department in establishing a stable and equitable funding system for the installation and maintenance of fish screening bypass devices. It advises the department identifying sources, applying for grants, local government agencies, etc., advises the department monitoring fish screening programs, advises the department in survey and study of fish screening technology, advises the department in preparing reports on capital costs and effectiveness of technology, and advises the department in the creation of priority criteria and priority listings, which are referred to in other statutes, of unscreened water diversions. So we felt that in this discussion of real, when you get down to project preference and spending money, the Fish Green Task Force is exactly where the discussion should occur, and then advice comes to the department through them. And so that's why, Madam Chair, in particular, we wanted to keep that loose, that preference language, put preference language in there, but not tie any certain percentages to cost-share funding. And that's not really, again, that's, did you get that? That's 496.085.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a question?
Thanks. Yeah, not having had the time to go through this, sure. I'm trying to figure out what is it that the Dash 1's doing to the 496.05? What's the difference?
The Dash 1 bills are essentially the four changes, the five changes on the testimony I handed out, Representative. It doesn't change anything about the 496.085. at all. What I was giving was an example of the comprehensive nature of the discussion on the preference language is all. That we have a publicly created body to advise the department on the fish screening program, that's all. That was my point on that. I'm sorry if I...
It's okay, Roy. In the Dash 1s, though, it changes at Section 5A. It's on page 2, starting on line 3. If you want to jump in, go ahead. Can you just state your name for the record, please?
Yes, sir. Ray Hardroad, I'm the program manager of the Fish Free and Passage Program for ODFW. I believe when we went through this morning, all it changes is the reference, and it's really in the last line on page 3, line 8, towards the end there. Because there's some renumbering done, that's the change of that.
Thanks.
So just to clarify, it does not change the right. intent of the task force or any of the sort of language that says this is what consists of, how many members and all that. That's already in statute.
Yes.
That was my reading of it when I compared it to the existing statute. So.
Madam Chair, continuing down on the third main issue, we wanted to clarify and make sure, and in the original bill it had dropped out, but so we asked in this third main issue, and this is any person who diverts water at a rate of 30 CFS or more is responsible for all maintenance of the fish screening device. That's in current law. In this rewrite of the law, that had dropped out inadvertently. We wanted to make sure that was stated in the law, again, to reaffirm that that's the responsibility of the over 30 water right owner to take care of all maintenance. And then the fourth issue was another issue that I don't know if we reached quite what Water for Life was looking for. We had originally started this by wanting to change from a $25 fee, which had been in statute since the early 90s, to actual cost, is what is stated in the bill right now, 2294. We had talked back and forth Water for Life on different amounts, but in the end, when we spoke to the chair of the Fish Green Task Force, he reminded us that this maintenance issue is such a large issue, looms large for the program, and is a very important policy issue for them. They have spent many meetings discussing maintenance issues and costs. And confirmed with him, his idea, and we agree at this point, is let us just delete this language referring to a particular cost amount, and let us, the Fish Green Task Force and the Commission, wrestle with the maintenance issue in its entirety in rule. And that is why we deleted that reference there.
So you'd be conducting a rulemaking process?
Yes.
To clarify that. Do you have any sense of how much the agency spends per biennium of general fund or fee dollars on maintenance? I mean, we must have an estimate of how much, either through time or physical labor, that you're actually spending.
Chair Dingfelder, this issue of maintenance, especially for these under 30s, where ODFW is required in statute to provide that, is a huge issue, and it's getting bigger. It's primarily because of the success of the program. Mm-hmm. Since the program, we put 1,000 screens out there that we're responsible for the maintenance for. And the maintenance comes from the fish screening surcharge, and that's a 25-cent surcharge on fishing licenses. Amounts to about $450,000 biennium. That's also used to run the Central Point screen shop that does a lot of maintenance. They don't get federal funds for that. And that's it. We used to have about the same amount, $400,000 in general fund. We've lost all of that.
So it's completely fee funded at this rate.
That's right, and it's insufficient at this time. And that's why the task force has been wrestling with this. How are we going to take care of these screens? The more we build, the more we have to maintain, and no additional funds to do that.
If I could, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, but just remember that the Fish Screen Task Force, while it gets a lot of money in from different sources, from some federal sources, and particularly from OWEB, about $4 million biennium, capital extremes construction costs, a good portion of that, particularly OWEB money, cannot be used for maintenance. It's only for new screens. And so in some ways, you're kind of building this monument and building all these screens, but in the end, the maintenance costs will eat you at some point in the future, is what the Screen Task Force has been very concerned about. And so that's why, again, they've wrestled with this quite a bit and have decided they'd rather try and tackle the whole issue on rulemaking if they could.
And you're also looking at doubling the goal with this bill. I mean, you'll be actually hoping to have more fish screens, so
yes.
There'll be even more of a cost for maintenance. Representative Burley had a question.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I do apologize for having missed the day that this committee had the hearing on this bill the first time. But, Roy, I'd like you to address what appears to me to be some inconsistency in what you're suggesting, because if the rationale for deleting lines 6 through 9 on page 3 is that you want to deal with this whole maintenance thing by rule, then why are you adding the language that talks about diverters over 30 CFS have to pay for all their maintenance? I mean, in one case you're putting one in and taking one out, and then you're saying, well, we want to do this by rule. So to me, that's not consistent. And secondly, Not many departments or agencies, I think, get to collect fees for actual cost. I'm not going to say nobody does, but most of the bills we've seen so far aren't that way. Why in your original bill didn't you just say a fee not to exceed and change that to maybe $50 or something like that instead of the actual cost? Might that work better?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, well, frankly, the actual cost language came about from all the discussions with the task force. They felt very strongly that when we do go have to, which is very, very rarely, and I don't think we ever used the $25 thing because it was such a minor amount, frankly, whenever we have to go out and try and do the minor maintenance, they felt so strongly that at some point in the future, see what happens if the minor maintenance doesn't get done, then the major maintenance becomes our total responsibility. So there's a lot of concern from the task force, and that was their actual language, that they said to the department, we want you to try and get actual cost language to try and protection, because if you don't have actual cost, you're going to have to end up, and the whole thing falls apart because it's not been maintained. Now the department's got to go out and rebuild the entire screen, and that's thousands of dollars. And so that's why the actual cost language was there, Representative. If I could go on that other point, too, on the over 30s, that over 30 language is in current law, and no group or ourselves are looking to change that current law. It just was dropped off inadvertently as the bills were, we combined a couple statutes together. But no one's having any problem with us making sure it's stated in law that over 30 is to be clear. Maintenance is all their issue. That's all.
One other question, sure. If I could. I might have missed this, for which I apologize, but why, in the first part of your amendments, are you changing the date from what was, I think, originally July 1991 to January 96? What was the rationale for that?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the rationale was that, in particular, Waterfly felt that by having 1991, that might have been too restrictive, and there might have been some other water rights are granted, and folks weren't told as a condition they had to have fish screening as part of their new water right. So that was one of the issues that we sat down with them and tried to work out kind of what would be an acceptable date, at least, because, again, the task force has said we want a date to give us a date certain. And so the way we finally came up in 96 was we contacted Water Resource and said, generally, what year is it that you, when you issue new water rights of any size, what year was it really pretty much a statewide condition that a new water right would have to have fish screening if fish are present? And the answer came back 1996, and that's how we got to 1996.
It's consistent. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hey, Roy, on page 2, line 12, mm-hmm. and I think you answered this question. I apologize. I perhaps missed it. Other state funds, what do you anticipate those other state funds potentially being? Page 2, line 12.
Madam Chair,
Representative
Smith, I believe at the time that original language was written, we were also receiving general funds, mm-hmm. and I think that's primarily where those other funds for maintenance would have been.
So just a quick follow-up.
So
it is potential if reimbursement from the fish screening sub-account did not occur, there is a potential that general fund could be used for this activity?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, under this language, yes, sir. I mean, there is that potential by putting other state funds in there. We wanted to have that potential. And if we receive other state funds like general funds, that also could be used.
Just a clarification, Roy, on that. And for instance, if there were federal funds, for instance, PCSRF, I'm
right.
not suggesting that would be necessarily used for that, but that this would allow, if there were federal funds that...
Is there a way...
Although they're federal, they are often then allocated to the state agency. So did you see if PCSRF would qualify, if that was ever... I mean, that's the only question I have about saying other state funds versus...
Madam Chair, I believe also the Measure 66 OWEB funds would be a big portion of that. That's really what we're using these days to build most of these screens. So that's the...
So that was the intent.
Wait.
reimbursement from the fish screening sub-account did not occur, there is a potential that general fund could be used for this activity?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, under this language, yes, sir. I mean, there is that potential by putting other state funds in there. We wanted to have that potential. And if we received other state funds, like general funds, that also could be used.
Just a clarification, Roy, on that. For instance, if there were federal funds, for instance, PCSRF, I'm not suggesting that that would be necessarily used for that, but that this would allow, if there were federal funds that...
Is there a way...
Although they're federal, they are often then allocated to the state agency. So did you see if PCSRF would qualify, if that was ever... I mean, that's the only question I have without saying other state funds in here versus...
Madam Chair, I believe also the Measure 66 OWEB funds would be a big portion. That's really what we're using these days to build most of these screens. So
that was the intent, really, was focusing on... Measure 66. Okay.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way, what would be the implications of tightening that language up? Then the other state funds is very, very broad. What would be the implications?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, my sense would be the implications were that we probably have less, to make it more restrictive, it just means there's less funds available for cost sharing with landowners.
Well, you know where I'm going with this. I have no problem with the use of federal dollars if that's what it's allocated for. I do struggle with the notion of using general fund, our very limited general fund for this type of activity, and this leaves that option open, especially without legislative approval, and that concerns me.
Well, one of the things, Representative Smith, this bill is going to revenue, and we can certainly raise that issue with the revenue committee, and if they, and since that's their purview, is to look at, sure that...
And Madam Chair, just, the Ways and Means folks may want to look at this as well. Within the purview of an agency is the ability to redirect up to 10% of its budget. Mm-hmm. And, 10% of ODFW or Water Resources budget could be significant. And that just provides concern to me. So, to me, it seems as if that ought to be tightened up.
Thank you for that comment. Any other questions? Did you want
to? No, nothing else.
So the intent when this was written, we were thinking Measure 66 money because, colleagues, that's where the capital funds for this program come from. And if I recall right, there is $4 million in the governor's budget set aside for this program of funding fish screens. Is that correct? $4 million, I think, for Measure 66?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Okay. Less land without $4 million. And Madam Chair, let me go ahead and look at that issue raised by Representative Smith and get back to him here. I'm not thinking that's an issue, but maybe he caught something that we didn't. So let me take a... I can get back to him and talk to him directly about that.
Okay. Thank you. Richard in the room. There you are. You want to come up? I'm assuming that since you guys were talking for 2 weeks, we can hear your side of the story, Richard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Richard Kosin, Sand Water for Life. We have appreciated the Chair's indulgence, and we have, for the most part, appreciated the assistance of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I think we can agree upon probably about 75% of the amendments with the department, as Mr. Ellicker indicated. The amendments put forth by ODF&W, we would suggest...
I'll be right back.
You want me to wait?
You can go ahead. And
okay.
If you'd like to share.
A couple of issues. It is our understanding that currently 75% to 80% of available resources have been specifically earmarked for the small diversions, those being 30 CFS and under. And I think that was the intent of the program when it was originated. Very clearly, the program developed as a need or from a need to install screening or bypass devices on the small diversions. With respect to the amendment listed on or from the Department of Fish and Wildlife Sub 2, The preference language, I think, is an improvement over the bill. We would like to see, if possible, some kind of further delineation. Again, if 75 to 80% of the dollars are going to the small diversions now, we suggested perhaps a two-thirds split, two-thirds to the small diversions, with a third being made available to those diversions, quote, large diversions over 30 CFS. And getting back to the issue that was raised, specifically with respect to language on page 3, the deletions of lines 6 through 9, it should be clarified that this is not part and parcel with the general administration of the program, but rather this provision, the fee not to exceed $25, extends to those individuals who fail to respond and fail to conduct minor maintenance. Our understanding is that number is few and far between, but to provide an incentive for individuals to be encouraged to conduct minor maintenance on the small diversions, rather than delete that language, we would suggest that you take the $25 fee that has been in statute, I believe, since 91, move that to a position of $50, $75, or $100. And from our standpoint, that does indeed provide the incentive for people to remain participatory in the program and conduct the minor maintenance. But again, it should be specifically clarified. That language pertains to individuals that fail to respond and fail to comply with the minor maintenance requirements. A question came up earlier in terms of that individual who fails to comply. And I would refer to subsection 11 on that same page, existing statutory provisions. And I believe Representative Smith had the previous question. In terms of authority, what is the outcome? It is clearly expressed there that the department maintains the authority to initiate an action to recover any costs incurred by the department when a person who is required to comply with this section fails to comply. So is there a built-in incentive for compliance? And I think the answer is unequivocally yes. Mr. Vice Chair, I think those predominantly our concerns. Again, we believe very strongly that the focus should remain on the small diversions. The number of diversions identified by the department during the early 90s would indicate very clearly that the majority of those diversions, specifically those under 30 CFS, were very small in from perhaps 0.5 CFS to 0.75 CFS to a cubic foot per second. Very small in nature, and that's where the vast majority of those diversions were found. So with that, I would be happy to respond to any questions. And if we have additional time, we'd be happy to work with the Department of Fish and Wildlife to address these two issues. Thank you.
Any questions for Richard? Representative Burley and then Representative Jensen, did you have a question?
Actually, I think this would be for both Richard and Roy, if I may.
Sure.
Now this
you can move over now and Richard now, okay.
Since Roy's willing to take another look at the question that Representative Smith brought up, I'd like to ask this. If we look at 6 through 9, Roy, and especially in light of what Richard said with respect to subparagraph 11 below that, If what you're trying to do through your amendments is get the actual cost for a, what's the term you use, I guess a major maintenance, is that the correct term versus minor? That's the term you're using here. For all maintenance. What if you left 6 through 9 as it was originally, where if you have a minor maintenance, you raise the fee to, as Richard said, $100. Then we add another subparagraph that gets at what you want. If it's a full maintenance issue, then we'll recoup the actual cost, which I think would help get at what you're saying, that you want an incentive to get the minor maintenance done while it's still minor maintenance. Would that work?
Madam Chair, would you like to go first or can I?
Never go ahead.
Go ahead, Richard.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the question, I think, to retain that language contained page 3, lines 6 through 9, I think would be prudent.
specifically with the inclusion of minor maintenance on line 7 and an adjustment of the fee, again for the incentive for the minor maintenance. But the question of maintenance in terms of, quote, major maintenance and minor maintenance has been long-standing in the program with the department, and the program basically assuming costs associated with major maintenance, and the participant, the landowner, assuming the costs for minor maintenance. Those definitions are fleshed out in existing statute, and they're found on page 4 of the bill, lines 37, 38, 39, 40, and 41. So in terms of a definitional standard, delineating the difference between the major maintenance and the minor maintenance, they're there. So I think my suggestion would be to retain that language, page 3, lines 6 through 9, and adjust the fee to provide a very well-defined, clear-cut incentive for the landowner to participate.
Richard, and I apologize for being out of the room. I have some constituents here. So that's my understanding of what, for the past 2 weeks, you have been trying to agree on a number, correct, on the fee number.
Madam Chair, I think the two issues that...
No, I know there's two, but I'm just asking about this. You could just not come up with agreement on the actual number to plug in there?
We would prefer, Madam Chair, that that language be retained.
Correct.
And that fee, if necessary, and in light of the passage of time, the $25 may indeed be way too low, but raise that to a level that provides that incentive for the landowner to participate.
And did you talk about what that level would be? Roy, and if you want to maybe...
Madam Chair, Deputy Fish and Wildlife. We talked about various amounts, and we thought we had some resolve, but frankly, then we went back to the Screening Task Force and said, no, that's way too low. So, I mean, I think if we want to, you know, Richard and I continue to work on this for a few days and maybe look to see if we can't, because frankly, if you take $25 and add zero to it to get right to the heart of it, I think you can call this a day on that piece.
I would be happy to work with these two gentlemen for the next couple hours. I think we can get this worked out.
Okay.
Sounds good to me.
Okay. Are you okay with that, Richard?
Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Okay. Did you have something you'd like to add, Representative Jensen?
No, I'm fine.
We'll lock you in a room. We'll come back in a few hours and see if you... You know, I would like to resolve this. Obviously, you know, Friday we're not having a session here in the Capitol, so we would like to bring this back on Monday. I'd like to do an extra few hours, and I would certainly appreciate if my vice chair could work with you on this.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, at what time would you like us in your office?
I don't know. I got to be in John Day at the crack of dawn tomorrow, so we've got, like I said, a couple hours today to get this worked out.
I'd say right after, make sure
so
I'm out right after.
After this, right after you're done here in committee?
Well, we're actually supposed to be having a floor session here shortly, aren't we?
We're listening for the bell.
They will notify us.
And
so
really, if you're busy, I'll take care of it.
Okay.
We can go outside right now.
So with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2294. I want to thank my vice chair. This is see when you hand the gavel off. Sometimes it's a good thing. Thank you. If you do want to go work on this, then. Okay, I appreciate that. We are actually staying here until we get called out. We're listening for a bell. Well, we have a hearing scheduled for a House bill. Are they going to call us again?
I called the way we wanted to.
Okay. We have a representative here who would like to testify on this bill. If maybe you can wait for that. Yes.
He's up first.
Yeah, we're going to have him up first. I'm opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2723, and we are fortunate to have Representative Mitch Greenlick here to provide an overview of his bill. Thank you for coming, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for allowing me to testify from here where I can get out of the chair. That's my current infirmity. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I appreciate you hearing House Bill 2723. I think we may have a couple of other people who want to do some brief testimony on this as well. This bill came up because of two things that happened in the last session. One was Representative Patty Smith had a client, I mean had a constituent, who bought a house, got a permit on it to do something, to build a garage, came back 10 years later to get a permit on it to do something else, like put a fireplace in or something like that, and found out that the house was on an illegal lot. That all the while it had been on an illegal lot, but that the county had missed it when the homeowners had applied for earlier permits. I've got this explanation of how you get houses on illegal lots, and apparently the story is something like this. Anybody can hold a piece of land and can divide it into tax lots. A tax lot's not a land division. You just create, let's say I have a piece of land, I have 160 acres, and I want my four kids to pay the taxes on their share. Now that they're going to eventually get to 106, so I create four tax lots, and each of them pays the tax on one of their tax lots, but that's not a division. It's just a single piece of land. Well, somewhere along the line, I might build a house on one of those four, which is probably okay, and then somebody sells off the other three. And here I am with a house on a lot that's never been divided and is now an illegal lot. And it would be particularly illegal if it was smaller than the minimum lot size at the time that the sale had happened. When we asked Multnomah County, and I had six of my constituents with a very similar problem in the 2005 session, when we asked Multnomah County if they could solve this problem for Representative Smith's constituent or for my constituents, in at least one of the cases, the answer was, no, we can't. We don't have the authority. Even if we agree we ought to make this lot legal, we don't have the authority because we're blocked by a particular set of state statutes. So we came into the 2005 session and did a special purpose bill to make the lot legal for Representative Smith's constituents. It turned out the county did find a way to make my constituents whole. They were six lots that had been illegally created and had houses on them by the time anybody found out they weren't legal. So I told the Land Use Committee in the 2005 session that in the interim I would work to create a bill that would give the cities and counties the authorization to make a lot legal if they so desire it. Not that would require them to make it legal, but would at least give them the ability to write ordinances that would make lots legal. I've since heard that at least one county has created an ordinance that would allow them to make lots legal, and when I called them to say, do you think this problem has been solved? The off-the-record answer I got, and I'm not naming the county, was, well, you know, we don't really think we have the authorization to do it, but we're going to try and do it anyway, and if nobody objects, perhaps we can get away with it. I said, well, does that mean you don't want a clarification of this in statute at the state level? I said, oh, no, please. We definitely want a clarification of this at the state level. It turns out there are a couple of issues in the, you know, as you know, the bills aren't coming out necessarily exactly as you want them to come out. There are a couple of issues, and the Department of Land Conservation and Development, I think, has some suggestions. I think there are folks in here from the counties to talk about it, and I really appreciate you having this hearing, and we will, if you wish us to, get you the amendments we need to clean this up, and we'll get it back to you in a fairly short time, if you so desire, we do that.
Great. Thank you so much, Representative. Can you stay for the
yes,
hearing,
I'll
or do you
stay.
Need to get back in committee?
Nope.
Okay, any questions for the representative before we call up the witnesses? Okay. I'm actually going to ask the Department of Land Conservation and Development to come up, because I know that they've been working with you on this bill, and then we'll hear next from Glenn Archambault, who traveled far, so I want to make sure that we hear him in case we're called to the floor. Thanks, Ron.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ron Eber with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, here to speak about House Bill 2723, and really to speak to the issue that's behind the bill, as Representative Greenlee mentioned, which is the issue of unlawful parcels. It is an issue that's out there. I would confirm what he has heard. I've been in touch with county planners for years, and most recently within the last week or so, trying to work on some amendments to deal with fix up this bill so it really gets at the problem, and they will all tell you bar none it's a problem and they need some clear authority. What I would suggest, and like I said, I have been working on some language. We were actually approached by Representative Buckley in the interim on this issue, I think because of Mr. Archambault's issues, and I've been talking to Glenn for many, many years about his problems in Jackson County. But I think in addressing this issue, you have to get at a couple of things. You have to deal, there's a retroactive aspect to this issue in terms of which of these prior illegal parcels do you recognize. You want to make sure that there's no benefit for that prior illegal activity in terms of future use. And there are some ways to do that, and I think in my conversations and work with the county so far, I think we're coming together with some consensus on those aspects of it. The other part that needs to be addressed is the prospective aspect. How do we prevent this from occurring in the future? How do we get proof of lawfulness into the record of the sale? Relying strictly on litigation, as Mr. Archambault will point out, is too late, and we need better remedies. We need to get the buyer focused on the correct issue. The current language that's either in the notice for escrow or that's in the seller's disclosure statement speaks about allowed uses. It speaks about non-conforming uses. It doesn't get focused on what is a lawful lot or parcel. And those are very specific terms that need to be looked at. But I think to get at this issue, we need to look at both the retroactive part and a prospective part. And the prospective part is difficult. The county recorders don't necessarily want to deal with it, nor the title insurance companies or the realtors, and we end up with the buyer sort of stuck in no man's land with this unit of land, and they can't get there from here. And then the land use program takes the hit for it, and we need to figure out a way to fix that. So I would just say that I have been working with counties on some language, and I think on the retroactive part, we're getting some consensus, and the department is more than willing to continue to act as the liaison and to try and bring you back a set of amendments together with Representative Greenlick that can deal with this problem in a comprehensive fashion.
Thank you. Any questions for the department? Representative McPherson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Eber. There's a tension here between the obvious need to recognize in a pragmatic way what has already happened and to not be overly rigid, but also to avoid, if not outright collusion on the part of private landowners, at least an indifference to our land use laws that giving too broad an exemption or protections to might invite. So that's the tension we're going through here. Your reference to the title industry just brings to mind that we have this very elaborate system of tracing ownership that apparently doesn't take any responsibility at all for whether a lot is buildable. And so we allow people to sell off, apparently described by meets and bounds, a certain area of land, whether it's buildable or not, and the title industry determines that the person who sold it actually owned it, but takes no responsibility for whether it's buildable, and that's really a pretty key aspect to the transfer of ownership. Any comments on that?
Chair Representative McPherson, I think that's right, and it's even more fundamental than that. It's not necessarily if the lot or parcel is buildable, it's whether it's lawful and even eligible to come in. Because the average buyer sees a field and there's a deed for it, it's fenced, there's a tax lot number. They're wondering what's the zoning, hopefully, and what use is allowed. They don't know to ask for that more fundamental question. Is this a lawful lot or is this a lawful parcel? And the tension that you speak to, I think, is accurate. And some of the things that I think can ensure that we deal with the practical issue of recognizing these unlawful acts without creating a development problem is you can, one, say that if at the time it was unlawfully created, it could have met those older standards, then, and for whatever, whether it was willful or accidental, and in many cases it is accidental, we can recognize it today. Secondly, you can say that we're only going to grant this authority to counties for these unlawful creations before a certain date. And I think most importantly, at least in the rural areas, you put you state clearly that the date of creation for these units that we're recognizing is the date they're now approved. Because there are a number of places in the rural areas where you can develop land if the lot was created before a certain date. So we don't want to allow any benefit necessarily for that prior illegal activity. And so by putting that current date on it, you take away any benefit. So at least they've got their title, they can deal with lot line adjustments and transfers with some security, but you don't bring forward any development benefit that might have accrued if it had been properly created back in time.
Follow up if I could.
Follow up.
Just as a sort of a suggestion for guidance as to the direction you go, I would be comfortable with being relatively more relaxed about things that have happened in the past if we have the right structure in place going forward to essentially make it a non-saleable lot, that you are not, that a landowner can't simply create a meets and bounds description of a new, you know, something that they have just of their own initiative turned into a tax lot and are going to sell off to somebody without going through some kind of more formal process to where it really doesn't become saleable and there's some obstacle to their ability to sell it unless it is a lawful lot.
Yeah. Chair Dingfelder, Representative McPherson, I totally agree. There are a number of ways to prospectively cut these things off by getting some piece of paper into the sale so that the buyer knows that they're buying the real McCoy. And I would suggest Mr. Schlack, I know from the counties will be coming up, agrees with that. You might want to direct some questions to Mr. Levy from the Realtors Association. I know he has some concerns with that approach. And we've been having a lot of discussions about how do we take a step forward here and solve that problem and yet not overburden the title or the transfer of property unduly. But yet, you know, get some protection in there for the buyer that they know they're buying something that's lawful and isn't, after being sold three times to somebody, they're sort of stuck with a pig in a poke.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for the department before we call up witnesses? I can't, it's hard for me to see over that way. Okay. Thank you, Ron. If you don't mind hanging out in case there's some extra questions.
But I'm here.
I know you'll be working with us on it. Okay, I'd like to call up Glenn Archambault. Did I get that right?
You got it right.
I know about how people mispronounce names, believe me.
You've got to remember that in the first grade.
I won't bore you with some of my horror stories. Thank you for coming today. We appreciate you coming all the way from, did you say Jackson County?
From Jackson County, the little town of Phoenix. Many of you probably know Ashland and Medford. We're right in between there, out in the orchards. This is my son, Malcolm. He travels with me to do presentations. He's a very computer tech person. And so we're going to get some help from Ian here.
Yeah, and we just need both of you to state your name for the record.
Sure. My name is Glenn Archambault.
I am Malcolm Archambault.
Is that satisfactory?
That's great.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. I'm going to give you a brief introduction here. My family, myself, we own a sheep farm in Phoenix, Oregon. That includes my wife, Dr. Terry Magruder. She's a veterinarian. We also own a veterinary hospital in the little town of Phoenix. We're going to talk about House Bill 2723 and an illegal division of land. And one of the reasons I'm here is to try to give you some reality of an illegal division of land. I know sometimes theory gets a little bit bland and boring. So that's why we brought some photos here.
our farm is an illegal division, part of that farm. And so what we're going to do, first off, is look at a photo from 1970 and what that land looked like. And this is important because this is back when this state was looking at land use laws and making some decisions. And so this piece of land you're looking at is orchards and pasture and a great deal of a variety of products. The land and the appearance has not changed much since that photo was taken in 1970. Very productive land, irrigated land. Probably if you've eaten a good pear in Oregon, it came from that valley. Very important to the rest of the people of the state of Oregon. By the way, folks, any questions you guys have, you're free to ask me. We're going to move on to another picture. That's an illegal barn. That's a very big building. It's about three stories tall. It was built for dairy and beef cattle, starting in the 30s and added on to many times. We purchased the property. That was a big focus, that barn, and the pasture that goes with it. It's roughly 9 acres of land. It's a perfectly legal lot of land, except for there's a little one-acre parcel on an old house in front of it that was illegally divided by previous owners. And they didn't do that in innocence. They knew exactly what they were doing. And they sold us the balance and other land with it.
All
right. We're going to go on to another photo. Now we're moving back a little bit. We're looking at that same barn, and that's a pasture. There are hundreds of ewes and lambs out in that field. As you can see, the land is open and clear. It's still pasture land. This was an important piece of land. Those little lambs love that field. And little lambs can only live in certain places in Oregon, and this is one of them. Let's go on to another picture. This is not a nice picture. This is the sales brochure of when we were sold this farm. That's a very big-name real estate company you're looking at in the state of Oregon and across the nation. People that many people look to for guidance, knowledge, and how you buy a home or a farm. There's little on this brochure that's the truth. The reality was that when we purchased the property, there were some major land use issues with this property. One of them was that there was an illegal house on the property. The property was being condemned for an interstate gas pipeline. The land contained an illegal division of land, all of which was known by the county planning department, the sellers, the realtors, and the title officers. All knew and understood the problems with the property, and it was in a complete set of documents. At the time of sale, we investigated this property. We hired a real estate attorney, a very competent man. We had a buyer's agent. My family, very knowledgeable people about real estate and about land use. We investigated this property very thoroughly. Never were any of these documents turned over to us about what was wrong with the property. I don't know how much more a person could do, but I want you to remember that brochure. It's very important. Let's move on to another picture. We're moving back away from that illegal lot. If you look way back in the left-hand corner, you can see the old barn and the grass and the pasture and the sheep there. Now, this land is surrounded by commercial farmland. You can see the green irrigated land. That's Bureau of Reclamation water, some very important water. I listened to you discussing irrigation water earlier. The producers there have kept that land clear and clean of illegal structures and illegal divisions of land. Let's move on to another one, Mac. As you keep moving out, you start seeing in the lower edges of this photo dryland pasture, and that land eventually becomes the Oregon wilderness. So one of the points of these photos is to show that illegal structures and illegal divisions of land don't happen just in downtown Portland. They end up on all sorts of resource land. And I'm a person that has a lot of experience with this because we spent 12 years in the Oregon court system discussing this parcel of land, including the Oregon Court of Appeals. So I've learned a great deal about this. I could take any of you right now, we could get some barbed wire, and we could go and create illegal divisions of land and sell them, and I know how to do it. So I'm going to take a moment. I want you to really look at that piece of land and think about how much time all of you spend on land use in preserving our resource lands. The parcel of land that I hold right now and the illegal division that adjoins it has created a disaster in this area. All the people that own that land are now fighting amongst themselves about what should become of this land. And the reason why that's happening is because they see no clear cut, no clear course in land use law. In Jackson County, you can pretty much do what you please. And this whole discussion shows that. I'm going to stop a moment. Does anyone have a question? Is there anything that you're sitting there going, what is this about?
Any questions? Why don't you go ahead and continue? We have some other folks that
sure. I understand that. I'm going to describe how these people created this illegal parcel. They had an agreement amongst several interested parties. They simply put a fence around the old farmhouse on this farm. We went to the county, recorded an addendum of contract describing that division. They had very clever attorneys do this, and they knew exactly what to put in place without somebody questioning it. And so in 1993, when they sold me that property, the people who did it later testified in deposition they knew exactly what they were doing, and they were able to carry that position all the way to the end of a very, very long court case, and the jury decided they had done no damage to me, and so we lost. And that took 12 years to get to that point. So I want to really emphasize that our courts have no answer to this question. And so today we sit there, we have no power in those buildings, we have no rights to them, we're not allowed to sell the land, and we're not allowed to use it other than the most primitive agriculture. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We appreciate you coming
here.
Sure. Are there any questions, or Representative Green, like, I don't know if you'd like to add anything?
Yeah, I was wondering why you can't sell it.
It's against the law. It's a platted subdivision of land. You cannot sell an illegal division of land within a platted subdivision. It's very clear in Oregon statute about that.
And it wasn't platted when you bought it?
It was platted when I bought it.
So it was sold illegally to you?
Yes. But there's nothing you can do to someone. I know that's what makes you scratch your head, doesn't it?
No, you just need to get Caldwell Banker back and
yeah.
Illegally.
Right? I know, yeah. Where are those guys when you need them? Any other questions?
Hey, thank you so much, gentlemen. We appreciate you coming here today, and thank you for your excellent assistance.
Thank you.
Might have to hire you on to help out the legislature.
That's a good plan.
Okay, I'm going to call up Dan Eisenbeiss from Thousand Friends, and then Art Schlack with the Association of Oregon Counties. If you want to come both up, be helpful. And we got a note from Linda Ludwig that she would like to testify but had to go to another hearing from the League of Oregon Cities. And for the record.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Daniel Eisenbeiss, Legislative Affairs Director for 1000 Friends of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on House Bill 2723. The issue of illegal lots is obviously an important and complex one. However, as this bill is currently drafted, we cannot support the legislation. Like Mr. Archambault's story, I think we've all heard accounts of the problems caused by owners who unwittingly purchased an illegal lot or parcel. As you consider this issue and these stories, we respectfully urge that in the interest of fairness, you also consider the impact to other landowners statewide, the neighboring landowners. We want to be fair to purchasers, their neighbors, and to Oregonians who follow the rules. This issue presents a number of problems, four of which I've listed here. One, the purchaser received less value in the land than expected because the lot or parcel is illegal. Two, local governments do not know how to handle existing illegal lots. Three, relief for owners of illegal lots may adversely affect neighbors who have complied with the law. And four, new illegal lots continue to be created. As currently drafted, this bill appears to be designed to address the first two problems, but not the remaining two. Measure 37 is teaching us that fairness is in the eyes of all landowners, not just those targeted in the new statute. This is one reason we underscore the impacts to all landowners. As a preliminary inquiry, it would be useful to know how many illegal lots exist, where they are located, and why they exist. Is this a widespread problem requiring legislation? If so, it is a problem that should be addressed through the land. Is it a problem that should be addressed through the land use system or through laws governing real property transactions? This bill applies statewide, and the impact should be understood. For example, a farmer might be surrounded by illegal lots and not know it. As this bill is currently written, new houses could surround this farmer. This proposed legislation could then hurt one landowner, even as it attempts to provide relief to another. The first problem identified above is a problem between the purchaser and the seller. It is essentially a property law issue for which remedies exist under current law. For example, ORS 92.018 provides the purchaser of a lot or parcel that was created without approval of the local government, quote, may bring an individual action against the seller, unquote, and awards attorney fees to the prevailing party as a disincentive to create illegal lots. My understanding of Mr. Archambault's case is that because no damage was found, he could not recoup attorney's fees under this part of the ORS. Litigation and insurance are the tools to be used when one party has treated another unfairly or illegally in a real estate transaction. As currently drafted, this bill changes land use rules to address malfeasance or negligence in a real property transaction. It would be undesirable to hold harmless owners of illegal lots who broke the law and created the problem in the first place. By owners, I mean sellers. The second problem identified above is the problem local governments face in deciding how to handle existing illegal lots and parcels, the sellers of such lots, and those who purchase them. Here, the bill as currently drafted provides too little direction to local governments, may expand inappropriate development and uses on illegal lots, and will likely create a new round of land use decisions that create new unfair results. There is no deadline for the creation of lots or parcels under the bill, so that at any time in the future, a landowning seller could create additional legal lots or parcels and then be held harmless under this bill. The result would be unfair to the many Oregonians who have spent their time and money to comply with the current law. It also rewards the landowner for creating an illegal lot. No person who sells or purchases an illegal lot receiving relief under this type of proposal should end up being in a better position than owners of legal lots. Many illegal lots could be approved under this bill for more dwellings on resource lands, creating the third problem I've listed in my testimony. There is, for example, no requirement that new development or improvement on a lot or parcel satisfy the criteria in place at the time the land was divided. There are no limitations on relief in this bill. Neighbors should not be surprised by new houses or uses that affect their use and enjoyment of their property or the livelihoods they may derive from it. It is important to prevent new illegal lots from being created. The fourth problem that I listed, if we're to address this issue, I think we have to do it in a comprehensive manner. If the remedies under current law fall short, it would be useful to know in what way so that more effective preventative measures can be taken. Under current law, the seller is liable, as are any parties to the transaction whose malfeasance created the problem. The local government, not the seller, is the entity that decides whether a lot is legal. It makes sense to require written confirmation from the city or county that a lot or parcel is legal before a land sale becomes final. This may be extra work for the local government, but it is a cost that can be recovered from the seller or buyer, and it's a good investment for local governments because it will pay off in time saved in avoiding future legal lot problems. It's also, I believe, not an undue burden for the realtor, purchaser, and seller involved in a transaction because although a fee and a little bit of extra work may be involved, it creates certainty in the real estate market, and that benefits all the parties involved. Thank you.
Art, why don't you go ahead and then we'll open up for questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, excuse my voice a little bit here.
Is that the capital crud?
I don't know what I've got, but I have a feeling it has to do with some insulation that I did a little job over the weekend that went down as well as in my eyes. So if I look a little red-eyed, you'll understand. Madam Chair, member of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. Do you have before you a problem that has beset the legislature for as long as I've been around as a land use planner and in this building representing the Association of Oregon Counties? I will say that last session I was able to work with Lane Shutterly and drive a very unique kind of situation that we could address the constituent that was in Patty Smith's area for a historic house that was sold to some people, and they were involved in buying a piece of property that was in a partition that had been approved by the county that had never been recorded. So the people went, got approval of something from the county, never implemented it, and then went and sold off a part of the land and to a person, and then they wound up with a historic house on a parcel of ground that was deemed not to be a lawfully created lot. Let me agree with Ron Eber, and I do that seldom, that this is an extremely complex issue because the lots that have been created are tax lots, and you have tax lots, you have lots that are created through partitioning, and you have subdivision lots. I, as a farmer, I can go, and this is one of the things that has created the problem. As a farmer can go, and let's say he's renting 40 acres to Representative Greenlink, and Representative Greenlink's farming that, and the farmer says, well, he's farming that, I want him to pay the taxes. So he goes down to the county, and he says, a tax assessor, I want you to create a tax lot on this 40 acres because I want Mr. Greenlink to know exactly how much the taxes are and I don't want to be bothered with those. And the tax assessor does that, records the tax lot, creates a tax lot. It can do that several different times. Well, once the tax lot is on the maps, people believe those are separate, lawfully created parcels. And this has transpired over years, and then you have the more overt situations where somebody has created a meets and bounds description, gets that recorded, and there's nothing that precludes the county recorder or the tax assessor from dealing with those properties as individual entities for the purposes of taxation. But they don't become lawfully created parcels for the purposes of land use planning, and that's where we wind up with this disconnect. I am happy to work with Representative Greenlink and others to see if we can't come up with a broader answer to this problem that is around every session. I'm not sure that it will solve all the issues, but I will, in saying that, I think it is imperative that if you do deal with some of the retroactive problems where the house is on a lot and it got a building permit and, you know, we need to recognize that, that somehow we need to deal with, if not stopping, at least limiting the creation of more of these illegal lots and parcels. And there's different ways to doing it that have been talked about for a number of years. There are advantages, and I'll say disadvantages, to most all of those because it either requires more work or it requires somebody to do something or maybe pay a fee. And so there's always some reluctance to do that. So that's the push and pull of that. So I'm happy to work with people to see if we can't address this issue.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And somebody much wiser than me once said, if it was easy, we would have resolved this a long time ago. And we have many issues like this, the legislature that faces today. So appreciate your testimony. Are there any questions? Representative Greenlink?
Thank you, ma'am. I would like to ask Mr. Eisenbeiss a question, please. I sat in the Land Use Committee for two sessions in 03 and 05, and here I heard cases that end up in the advertisements for Measure 37, where there were just stupid land use decisions, and I thought it would be great to get a button that I could pass out that was, you know, rule out stupid land use decisions, and because there had been some pretty dumb decisions along the way. Now I just want you to consider, in the light of this person in Corbett who didn't do anything illegal, innocently bought a lot from somebody who also didn't do anything illegal. Something illegal had happened some other time. I mean, they bought a house. And they bought a house and they lived in that house and they got a permit to do something else in that house, and then they came back again a few years and asked for another permit and they couldn't get a permit. Are you suggesting that we not, that to rectify that situation and make their lot legal would be a bad thing because it would be rewarding illegal activity, or it would be somehow harmful to any of their neighbors or anything like that? I mean, you would argue against the ability for somebody to consider that case on its merits and have the authority to remedy the problem if it made sense to remedy it?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Greenlink, no, I'm not arguing that we should seek to effectively punish the purchaser or the seller in that case, but I'm suggesting that in going about crafting legislation to address such situations, that we do so very carefully, consider some of the points that Mr. Eber brought up in terms of only allowing uses that would have been permitted at the time that the illegal lot was created, not letting this extend into the future without also making an effort to prevent the creation of new illegal lots. We don't want to create a system that effectively rewards the cases where sellers are intentionally doing this.
Great, thank you. Madam Chair, I certainly agree with everything you've just said.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate it. We appreciate your offer, Art, to work with Mr. Ebert and
represent. I should offer that 1,000 Friends of Oregon would also be happy to partake in such discussions.
Okay, thank you. And last up, we have Harlan Levy.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, I am Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I want to thank you for this opportunity to present testimony on this very difficult issue. First, I want to thank Representative Greenlicht for bringing forward this bill. This is an issue that needs to be addressed, and we do support this bill. This deals with the retrospective aspect to the problem, and this bill would merely allow cities and counties to legalize these lots after the fact. It doesn't require any particular outcome. It just, as Representative Greenlicht said, just authorizes them to go out and create local ordinances that would allow for these lots to become illegal. It doesn't require anything in particular. It doesn't require a city or a county that doesn't want to do it to do it. It's a permissive statute. Our concerns come up when we start talking about the prospective piece, and there's nothing currently in the bill that does, but you know, in my discussions with Mr. Eber, we've run a few ideas across one another. The problem is we're concerned with overburdening real estate transactions, most of which, the vast majority of which, do not suffer this problem with undue burdens, with burdens for, you know, sellers that need to go out and find particular documents, sellers that don't know where to look for these documents. We don't want to make the process that expensive and that time-consuming that it becomes difficult to sell real estate in the normal course. This problem arises because these lots are created. The problem is at the act of creation, which is the act when the county recorder authorizes someone to record a new deed. So that is where the focus ought to be. To prevent these from happening in the future, what we need to do is look at the act that is actually creating the new lots. And I'd be happy to work again with Mr. Eber and with Mr. Schlack and with all the other parties involved. If we could find a way to make sure that when the lot gets created at the county, that it is a legal lot, that would stop additional illegal lots from being created, ultimately sold, and moving on down the line in the chain of title. So I guess that's pretty much all I have today. I do want to note, the representative from the Thousand Friends mentioned the statute RS 92.018 does provide a remedy for buyers to seek both damages as well as equitable relief from a court when they are sold one of these illegal lots, and the statute provides for attorney's fees. I'm not familiar with Mr. Archambault's case. I don't know why he did not prevail on that, but the statute does authorize buyers to go after these shysters that are selling these lots and go after them not only for their damages but also to recover their attorney's fees. So I wanted to make note of that. You do have statutory authority already on the books for that. With that, I will be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Holland. I think Representative Cannon has a question.
Madam Chair, it's perhaps more of a comment than a question, but Harlan, you could certainly feel free to respond. And that is, as a buyer or a seller in a real estate transaction, I would be perfectly happy to slow down the transaction a little, pay a little bit more for the transaction, if only to get the assurance that the land I'm buying, the lot I'm buying, was created legally, or the land I'm selling, the lot I'm selling, was created legally. Just as, you know, there are already a bunch of items on that transaction that assure me that, for instance, the seller actually owns the land. And I think it, I mean, my sense of this is that's a perfectly reasonable place to at least collect some money to pay for the processing of this fee, perhaps where that due diligence should come in. I just think that it's such a fundamental, important part of that contract that we know that what we're getting is, in fact, legal. That's. I know we're not talking about dollars here. I don't want to get into that conversation, but I don't know if you have any response to that.
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Cannon. The issue is, what do we need them to do? I mean, what is the proof that is required? I mean, a shyster that wants to sell an illegal lot is going to figure out a way to do it, no matter what protections we create. And we, you know, don't want to burden all of the real estate transactions and create all of the potential, you know, what I had heard Mr. Eber recommend here was that the seller needs to provide some type of written documentation from the county to the buyer upon sale that the property was legally created. Well, I don't know what that document is going to be. I don't know if counties even know what that is going to be. I mean, county planning staffs are completely inundated with Measure 37 claims right now. They can't even do their planning activities. How much time are you going to add to the transaction if every single sale is going to require that that piece of paper be generated by the county, be put in the paperwork, and be given to the buyer? It could have a significant effect on real estate transactions and the real estate activity in the state. We don't want that to happen. And again, this is a very few number of you know, bad actors out there that are doing these things. The vast majority of real estate transactions do not suffer from this problem, and yet it seems to be a very broad brush, a very broad way to deal at a problem that, again, could be addressed at the creation, at the time of creation, at the time that the recorder takes the deed and records it, a new meets and bounds description for a parcel. Maybe they need to check with the planning department to see if that was legally created before they accept the document to be recorded.
Okay. Representative Pearson, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's really a follow-on to that question. I mean, in every real estate transaction that involves any conventional financing, there is a title company involved, and their function is to make sure that the seller owns what the seller is conveying to the buyer. And yet now, in our more complex society, what the seller is conveying isn't just a chain of title, it is a right to occupy a lot. And yet that is carved out of title insurance. And so what about having having title insurers take responsibility for whether it is a valid lot as well as whether the seller really owns it?
Chair Dingfeld, Representative McPherson, that would be fine with me and with my people. The question is,
I realize that you're as close as we're going to get to the title insurance industry probably in this hearing today. So, if you had an observation,
it would make sense. It would make sense. I know that one of the general exclusions on every title insurance policy that gets issued is zoning, and one of the key points of zoning is was the lot legally created or not. Sure, theoretically, the legislature could require that, you know, title insurance policies ensure the zoning as well as the legality of the lot. I think that you might have a fight on your hands if you tried to impose that, though.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Greenwood, do you want to...
I just
want
to make a very brief comment. I mean, most of the real estate transactions are for platted lots. If they're a platted lot, that's not going to be a problem. I mean, I think we're basically talking about transactions that are not for a house on a platted lot or a vacant platted lot.
And do we have any idea how many transactions that is? Any idea how many transactions that is?
That's a relative proportion.
Yeah, per year, or the relative proportion to other types of transactions. And that type of information would be helpful if you or maybe the department can come back and provide that.
Chair Dingfeld, I will see if I, again, I hear most of this from the department, and you know, as these bills come up, but I'll see if my members have any stories to tell. I'll see what I can get.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you very much for hearing this, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you for being here and helping us understand this bill and the genesis of it. What I think I'm going to ask is for the department and the counties and the realtors and a thousand friends to work with Representative Greenwood and see what you can come up with before we bring this bill back. Appreciate it. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2723. And colleagues, before we adjourn, I just want to remind folks that Friday we will not be here. If the weather cooperates, we will be having a field hearing in Bend in Representative Burley's district. We are going to leave the Capitol at 7 a.m. sharp. Grab your coffee on the way, and that's when the van's pulling out, so unless you want to try to hitchhike over to Bend. For those who are joining us, I know that a couple members have already mentioned that they won't be able to make it, and we will be having a field trip from 9:45 until 11:45. Then we'll be having lunch where the hearing will be, which is the Bend City Council Chambers. We've invited Bend Mayor and City Council members, I believe. Okay, and the County Commissioners, so hopefully they'll be joining us. And then we will be having an informational meeting on renewable energy strategies. We'll be hearing from several groups from Central Oregon and other areas, including... we'll be hearing from the solar energy folks, from sustainable energy, biomass, the Warm Springs, forest products folks will be there. We'll be hearing from Steve Johnson, who's the Central Oregon Irrigation District, about hydropower, fuel cell, IDATEC, and then geothermal. And then we will be having a public hearing on House Bill 2625, which Representative Burley and I are co-sponsors on that bill, relating to funding for acquiring fuel cell systems. And then we will hope to leave promptly at 3 o'clock so we can get back to the Capitol by 6 and you can be on your way. So just if you have any questions, please contact Kat, and look forward to hopefully a good field session in Bend. Thank you. With that, I'm going to adjourn the House Energy and Environment Committee.